You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 2nd of November 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show,
Donald Trump. Don't boo! Vote! Don't boo! Vote! Booing doesn't help. Voting helps.
And if you are so eligible, you've got six more days to make your mind up. As the rest of us endure the climactic indignities of the 2016 US presidential election, which of the world's countries have most reason to worry about the result? My guests Samira Shackle and Tim Marshall will be here to discuss that and the day's other top stories, including corruption scandals at home and tensions with India, a headline which could have been written about Pakistan any time since 1947. But why are both worse than usual at the moment? Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan finds some more civil servants and journalists he hasn't already sacked or arrested. Where and when will the post-coup purge end? And which actually are the world's most corrupt countries? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests today are Samira Shackle, a London-based freelance journalist, and Tim Marshall, editor of thewhatandthewhy.com, foreign affairs analyst, author most recently of Prisoners of Geography. Welcome both. And just 1 week from now, we shall hopefully be enjoying the first flushes of blessed relief of never having to think about the US presidential election campaign of 2016 ever again. While all such contests command the attention of the world, none has commanded more and more confused, terrified, and generally aghast attention than this one. But while the whole world has a stake in the race for the White House, who will be most anxious? Tim, first of all, would there be any country anywhere in which a plurality of people and polity would actually be hoping Donald Trump wins this?
Russia.
Do you think so, really?
No, I don't. I think that's overblown, but because actually they know that Mrs. Clinton is actually quite hawkish on foreign affairs and is possibly more likely to get involved if there is trouble in Europe than Mr. Trump would be. So, no, I just threw that in because there's this joke, you know, that Putin is going to vote for Trump. No, I think there's 193 nation states, and I think 193 nation states are interested because it does matter. I'm going to give you the list that you were asking for, but I would preface it with saying that there is this saying that America has presidents and America has interests. The presidents come and go, the interests remain. And so whoever...
This was Palmerston's observation made indeed many, many decades ago as well. No permanent friends, no permanent enemies, just permanent interests.
And so although the individual and the personality does matter and they do make decisions that are far reaching, for example, Nixon in China, etc., etc., you know, you can overstate it. Now, that said, yeah, Russia absolutely looking very, very closely to see if they get a hawk or someone that might not push as far within NATO if there is any belligerence towards the Baltic states. For example, I'm just back from China last week. Everyone I met was saying the same question. Who's going to win? Who's going to win? And they are really fascinated by this guy, Trump, because they've never seen anything like it. Other top tier is the European Union, and that's because of the trade deal, such as TTIP, which is on ice. If Trump gets in, I can't see it ever going through. If Clinton gets in, maybe. The whole Pacific region is watching incredibly closely because of the relationship that they will then have with China. And then you've got the second tier down, Mexico, the Baltic states, the United Kingdom, on their individual relationships. And then you've got the rest of the world. But fundamentally, Russia, China, the EU, and the Pacific region.
Samira, what's your view of how this is being seen from this country, Britain, which obviously has for many years prided itself as a political and a physical bridge between Europe and the United States, and may have had ambitions of becoming more of that, having, I guess, I can't make this bridge metaphor stretch. if you elongate a bridge from one side because they've decided to put a gate, and you know what I'm saying,
yeah,
anyway.
Yeah, I know what you're getting at.
I don't. Carry on.
I'll develop it as Samira talks. But what's your perception of how this has been seen from Britain, this election?
Well, I mean, there's huge fascination with it, as there always is with US presidential elections. I think partly because US presidential elections are seen as important all over the world, and partly because of this, it's a horrible phrase, but I'm going to use it anyway, special relationship, which has sort of been a political priority for successive leaders in Britain, certainly, if not always reciprocated. And I think that that's probably particularly thrown into relief at the moment with big questions about what our place in the world is going to be. The fact that we're withdrawing from the European Union, I think that Theresa May and company will have been focusing or sort of planning for the relationship with America to be sort of continually important. And that sort of and something that came up a lot in the referendum campaign, that, you know, we can still have this relationship with the US, with Canada, with Australia, with the other sort of English-speaking countries around the world. And I think the prospect of a real unknown quantity, which is what Trump is above all else, I think, unknown quantity, intemperate, to say the least, coming into power, and also someone who's hugely unpopular in the UK, you know, sort of Theresa May cozying up to President Trump, I don't think would play particularly well in the media or with the public. So I think that's a real concern, given that we have these big questions about what we're going to be after Brexit actually happens and who our allies are going to be. I think the prospect of absolutely uncharted territory being sort of potentially on the cards with our other biggest ally is a worry.
Tim, a thought that vaguely occurs to me is that if Hillary Clinton wins, and the polls suggest that that's still by far the most likely outcome, there will be, I think, for reasons we've just been discussing, something of a global sigh of relief that might be audible from deep space. If that's the case, might it actually work to her advantage that she's run against Trump, that the world has had to spend the last year or so peering into this abyss? Does that actually give her diplomatic capital that she might not otherwise have had?
I think it gives her a honeymoon period where there is this collective sigh of relief. And that is because you get a known quantity. Now, I mean, yes, she is pretty hawkish, but you get a known quantity and you get someone that knows how the levers of power work and is not likely to flail out. Whereas Mr. Trump, it would appear, could easily flail out. And I think what's also happening, the reason there is so much interest, and I think there is more interest in this US election than I can ever remember, even with George Bush, who, you know, was quite a character. I've been, like I said, I was in Beijing, I've been in Madrid recently, Berlin, Amsterdam, and people just say, Trump? You know, that's all you've got to say, Trump, and you know what the question is. The question is, OMG, what's going on? And it's such a pertinent question because you haven't just got this uncertainty in the United States. It's come at a time when there's great deep uncertainty in large parts of the world, within the EU, within the Eastern European states facing off against Russia, with the stalling of globalization, with the rise of China. It's this new time. There's a crisis, I believe, of confidence in democracy. All this is swirling around, and then you throw into this simmering pot this boiling man called Trump.
Final thoughts on this subject from each of you, and I'll ask you first, Samira. This is where I invite you to offer up some hostages to fortune. Who's going to win next week?
Oh, I think Clinton will inch over the line. I hope so anyway.
Okay, Tim?
I think the next president of the United States will be the winner.
Honestly, I've given up on prediction because I'll tell you why, sorry, very, very briefly. Because of this, we are in an era of uncertainty and we don't know just how many people who are so dissatisfied with the state of things just throw their hands up and say, you know what, let's try something else. I give you Brexit as an example.
Well, indeed. You could, of course, be wrong about that. Not impossible, say, Trump wins the election, some scandal completely overwhelms him between now and inauguration, and the next president's Mike Pence.
Well, a very brief story. There were two young brothers. One ran away to sea. The other one became Vice President of the United States of America, and neither of them were ever heard of again.
That joke was actually told by a Vice President, yeah. I think, but perhaps perfectly. I forget which one it was.
But I take your point. Pence is he's pretty right-wing, incredibly conservative on social issues, but yes, he is this sort of calm Thunderbird puppet haircut guy that is sitting there waiting, and if something goes terribly wrong, he is going to be the man. On the other side of the fence, if Mrs. Clinton was ever impeached, nobody still knows the name of her running mate.
Tim Kaine.
apart from some know-alls. Bless you, Kane. Thanks very much.
Let's move along now to one of the countries which has better reason than most for staying up late next Tuesday night, or if I've got the time differences right, taking next Wednesday morning off. This is Pakistan, currently beset by domestic tumult and international tension, remarkable even by Pakistan's formidable standards. At home, Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif is being investigated over allegations of corruption, while abroad, the latest escalation in the row with India over recent violence in Kashmir is the recall of six diplomats from New Delhi. Samira, first of all, what is Nawaz Sharif being accused of?
So it's all to do with the Panama Papers revelations, which were about 7 months ago, if you remember. Where there
seems
sort of,
like a lot longer ago than that, doesn't it?
Yeah, it wasn't that long, actually. I think it was in April. The papers didn't name Nawaz Sharif by name, but three of his children did come up in it, and they had offshore companies in the British Virgin Islands through which they'd purchased London property, sort of expensive properties in Hyde Park and the like. So at the time, he sort of brushed it off and said, you know, this is perfectly legitimate. My family is allowed to own property. There's no law against them owning property overseas. And of course, the Sharifs are one of the richest families in Pakistan. You know, they've got a whole host of businesses from sugar mills to steelworks and all sorts of things. But the accusation of corruption and money laundering and various other nefarious activities has hung over them for years and years. This isn't Nawaz Sharif's first spell in power. And I think there's sort of growing anger about that sort of sense of corruption and so on in the elite echelons of society, while the whole country sort of struggles along with huge swathes of the country in terrible poverty, with a massive energy crisis where you don't really have electricity throughout the day pretty much anywhere unless you are rich enough to pay for your own private generator. And all these things, this idea of getting rich off the backs of the people is something that's been going on for a long time, but is causing more and more anger now. And in this particular instance, Imran Khan, who is very keen to call for Nawaz Sharif to step down at any possible opportunity, I should stress that he's called for him to step down lots of times since he was elected in 2013.
On form, yeah. He's bound to be right. If I've done the maths right, Nawaz Sharif, is it resigned once, overthrown once? Am I missing anything else?
Yeah, that's right. Okay. And Imran Khan has held big protests several times saying, I'm not leaving until Nawaz Sharif steps down, and then has sort of eventually had to climb down. And this time again, he'd been sort of rabble rousing about it. He'd planned to hold a huge protest in Islamabad today, a big march on Islamabad that he said was sort of calling for Sharif to resign, which he's stepped back from now. He called off the protest. The government is saying it's because he couldn't gather enough people for it. He's saying it's because the Supreme Court announced, as they did, that they would investigate these corruption charges into Nawaz Sharif. But it's actually quite good for Sharif that they've done that, because these things tend to move incredibly slowly in Pakistan. They take on average, I think, 4 or 5 years. So that sees him well over the next election, which is due for 2018. So for now, he can just say it's under investigation. I'll be exonerated.
Tim, looking at the recent flare-up in Kashmir, If we look at it on a scale where one is sort of, you know, agreeable, settled peace, six is maybe Kargil 1999 and eight is the 1965 war, where are we at the moment?
I would say six-ish.
That bad?
Yeah. Yes, there's been more bloodshed today. The Pakistanis saying the Indians are firing indiscriminately towards their positions. There's been more deaths on the Pakistani side. And also, the Kashmir, as Samira will know better than me, is absolutely boiling at the moment. And it goes back to the death of a very young activist this summer, which just took the lid off this long simmering protest in Kashmir, and it is boiling. And you throw into that these cross-border incursions, and I would put that into the mix of what's happening with Sharif's, because it has come at a time when the army is not particularly happy with him. They would like him to perhaps take a slightly tougher line against India. At the moment, both sides are trying to calm it down, but it is at a six, because there's already been a significant amount of bloodshed on either side. And if either side makes the wrong move, we'll go up to the eight of the Kargil thing that you referred to.
Samira, on that thought, and there have been, it's come and gone over the last few weeks. You get sort of placatory noises from both Islamabad and New Delhi, and then something else happens. So in this instance, somebody recalls some diplomats, et cetera, et cetera. is that the sense you get, that both sides actually do want to keep a lid on this? Is escalation actually in anybody's interests at this point?
No, I don't think it's in anybody's interests, and they're both aware that they're both nuclear powers. I think that I don't think there's any appetite for all-out war on either side, but there is this kind of, as Tim says, bloodshed localised in Kashmir, and there's also this real sort of ramping up of rhetoric and diplomatic relations souring and so on. I don't think that that anyone wants to see a full-on war, but both the Indian and Pakistani governments, I think, are also trying to play to their publics, and both in both countries, you know, it's really bad. I mean, there's lots of anger amongst people against the other side. There's, after an attack a few weeks ago by allegedly Pakistani militants on Indian soldiers on an Indian army base, there was a huge pressure, I think, on the Indian government to do some sort of retaliation and sort of show them we won't take it. And I think that's happening on both sides.
Pakistani side is also some private armed gang groups, which are probably are controlled by the government. There's others that are not quite in control of the government, the militias, or the jihadists. And if they strike in such a manner inside India that India blames Pakistan,
which is India's stock response whenever anybody strikes,
then things can get out of control. And this is also comes at a time where they're busy arguing about water, the control of the headwaters. So, you know, it is one of those periodic dangerous times. I think we're at six. Normally, you dial it down to four after a few weeks of uncertainty.
Just on this, though, finally on this, Samira, that public opinion you mentioned in Pakistan, which has, well, it's been angry on both sides in the last few weeks. If you judge, especially by both the Pakistani and the Indian newspapers, which are, of course, both judging and reflecting the mood of their readers. Yeah. But how potentially dangerous is that in itself? I mean, to what extent can the leadership of Pakistan in particular control the mood of the people or ignore the mood of the people? Can they, in fact, end up getting bounced into a position they didn't want to be in by dint of anger they helped stir up in the first place?
I think that's probably more of a worry in India, actually. My impression, I haven't been there in the last month or so, but my impression is that public pressure is more so from the Indian side, I think. In Pakistan, there's quite a lot, while there is a sort of anti-Indian feeling and anger about the situation in Kashmir, which bubbles up at different moments, I think that the people in Pakistan are quite preoccupied by the sort of internal problems that this signifies. So to mention that some of these terrorist groups are controlled by elements of the military apparatus of the intelligence services, and the government doesn't really have anything to do with that. There's been a huge furore recently where a prominent journalist, Cyril Almeida, published an article where he said that basically that the civilian government had been standing up to the military and had said, stop funding these terrorist groups, we're internationally isolated, people don't want to meet with us, and, you know, we're really losing favour with the US, with everyone, basically. So you have to stop doing this, you have to stop this shadow policy. That was reported on, which was quite unthinkable. The guy had his sort of travel rights stripped, he was put on a no-fly list. And so there's this real sort of preoccupation with what this whole thing signifies about the civilian-military relationship, which is kind of at the core of governance in Pakistan. So I think people are probably more worried about that than about agitating for war with India.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Tim Marshall and Samira Shackle. Coming up next, the increasingly oxymoronic topic of Turkish press freedom.
Can you smell that popcorn? Well, while you're waiting in line, let me tell you about some of the standout guests we've spoken to recently on The Cinema Show. This year's Palme d'Or winner Ken Loach told us how going back to basics was integral to the strength of his winning film, I, Daniel Blake.
Paul wrote two characters which have quite simple, straightforward situations.
Fellow Palme d'Or winners Jean-Pierre and Luc Dardenne told us how reaching the heights of the film industry can have its downside.
Because after Cannes, the reactions were mixed. Some good, some less good.
And Canadian filmmaker Xavier Dolan gave me a glimpse into his creative process.
What matters in making movies is all the elements are working and walking at once in synchronicity.
So now you've heard the trailer, all you need is the main attraction. Tune in to The Cinema Show on Monocle 24 every Friday at 20:00 in London. Or download the podcast now. You'd better hurry with that popcorn though. The movie's about to start.
Thank you.
You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Samira Shackle and Tim Marshall. Now, 3.5 months since the coup d'etat that failed to unhorse Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, anyone following the story might have assumed that by now he had sacked, suspended, arrested or otherwise purged everyone he might possibly hope to get even with. Apparently not, however. In the last few days, another 10,000 civil servants have been fired and 15 more media outlets closed. The highest profile target has been Cumhuriyet, Turkey's oldest secular newspaper, whose editor and several journalists are among the latest of the usual suspects to be rounded up. Tim, does this even appear coherent anymore, or is this just now one of those things that has acquired its own momentum and is sort of acting more or less of its own accord?
I think it's coherent. I think it's a coherent strategy to completely stamp out any opposition and become the Sultan of Turkey, with no opposition anywhere. He's sorted out most of the military that might have stood up to him. He's sorted out most of the secularists that might have stood up to him. The civil war with the Kurds is now back on, and press freedom and democracy has gone backwards. And I say that with knowing that the attempted coup was anti-democratic, and that he was democratically elected.
Indeed, so.
And consequently, you know, democracy in that sense was saved because the coup failed. However, the 10 newspapers, 2 news agencies, and 3 magazines, and it brings it to 160 media organizations that have been closed down. Is it really feasible that there were 160 media organizations in Turkey that were either sympathetic and helping Kurdish terrorism and or were Gulenists? It's not credible. What is credible is that he is stamping out every last vestige of opposition. I think he's catching up with Putin.
He does credit journalists with a heartening degree of sense of purpose and organisation, which I have to say I've rarely found among our colleagues around the world. Samira, what message is Erdogan trying to send here? Is it, as Tim suggests, that I'm in charge, nobody else in charge, thou shalt have no other sultan before me, etc.?
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's sort of opportunistic use of the coup, and the fact that actually people across the board, obviously there were some people who are ardent Erdogan supporters who opposed the coup, but there are also people who, and I've spoken to sort of young left-leaning Turkish writers who are very secularist in their outlook and have a lot of reservations about the Erdogan and AKP project, but who still didn't want the coup to happen and were happy that it was defeated in the first instance, because there's this huge sort of cultural resonance of military coups. It's a country like Pakistan that we were just talking about that spent a lot of time under military rule. People didn't want that. They wanted the sort of will of the people to be respected and so on. So I think it's exploiting that, and the fact that people didn't want, people from different political camps didn't want the coup to be successful, exploiting that to behave in that sort of support for democracy, to behave in a thoroughly undemocratic manner and consolidate his power even more than he had already. And it's very worrying, I think, that, you know, it's not just the 160 media outlets closed and over 100 journalists detained. It's also things which go a bit more below the radar, like academics having their travel rights taken away, being on exit control lists, having their passports stripped, and, you know, just sort of people studying literature at universities, not necessarily people who are involved in any sort of political activism. So this idea that you have some involvement with the coup, you're sympathetic to the Gulen camp or whatever it is being used for very blatantly, not in a particularly subtle manner, for a huge scale clampdown on not just press freedom, but freedoms of all sorts.
Tim, final brief thought on this one. Is Erdogan still so important to the West that he can't be pulled up on any of this?
He cannot be pulled up on it to the degree which, if he was not so important, he would be. The European Union still needs Turkey and cooperation and good relations because of the refugee migrant crisis. The United States and others still need Turkey because it is in a very important NATO member. Consequently, that is why the accusations and the rhetoric against what's going on has been muted.
Okay, well, finally tonight, we should look at an investigation into South Africa's President Jacob Zuma, which has found evidence of corruption within his administration, a revelation which seems unlikely to prompt widespread exclamations of gadzooks from KwaZulu-Natal to Cape Town. But it might nudge South Africa up a couple of notches in Transparency International's Corruption Perceptions Index, the most recent of which, a few months back, didn't even list South Africa among the top 10. So which are the world's most corrupt countries? Was what we wanted to talk about. And I thought it would be fun to talk to you both about your personal experience thereof. Samira, of the places you've travelled or worked in, are there any that struck you as outstandingly bent?
Yeah, I did. I wasn't actually working there, but when I visited Nigeria when I was a teenager and was quite astounded at just people ask very clearly for bribes a lot of the time. So sometimes I remember just having my passport checked at the airport, and it was initially there's a page in your passport missing, and when I was just very flustered about it, it was basically like, oh, come on, just give me some money. And so that was quite obvious, which in a way, while it's not particularly pleasant, it avoids the awkwardness of the bribe situation. I mean, I've actually avoided having to give bribes in working situations before by just feeling far too awkward to initiate the process, and eventually people think, okay, well, this woman's obviously thick, let's just wave her through. It does work.
I've been in exactly that position myself, because Tim, there is weirdly a strange etiquette about it, isn't there? Like, what I have noticed is that the bribe-seeking official gets incredibly offended if you acknowledge out loud that he's seeking a bribe.
Absolutely. You never actually say how much.
What are you supposed to say?
Well, okay. Awkward, isn't it? That's what I've always said. Mate, look, how much do you want?
Yeah. On a serious note, it is awful. Corruption is awful. It corrodes societies. It means you can't make good business decisions. It perpetuates poverty. But I put my hands up and say, with no pride, I have occasionally committed something that I should not have done. For example, going into Iraq in the Saddam years, they used to want to give you an anti-AIDS injection.
I remember
all
it well.
Westerners, and they used to bring out the biggest, nastiest, dirtiest needle you've ever seen in your life.
They showed me that as well.
Yeah. However, there was a $50 fee where you could get a doctor's note that you would go and get this injection later, which I signed. I mean, everyone knew.
I think it was 100. What year was this? I think it had gone up by the time I went.
Another one is to say, ah, yes, I can see that perhaps I haven't done all the paperwork. I wonder if there is a tax on this. And if there is a tax on it, then the person is not losing face because you then pay your tax. Now, I'm not saying this should happen, and I certainly don't think it shouldn't happen in government circles. Journalists tend to try to get round things in order to get to places and see what the hell is going on. And so I'm not proud of it, but there were a few occasions when I said things like, is there a tax that perhaps would
an administrative fee?
Exactly.
Yeah, no, I have been in broadly similar situations, but it is weird. As Tim points out, Samira, quite rightly, it does have an extraordinarily corrosive effect on a society, because it spreads and it infests absolutely everything, to the point where people, buy driving licenses rather than sit them with predictable consequences in a few places I've been to. How do you go about sort of breaking that down, though? Can you only hope that the leadership sets an example?
I think so. And if you look at the most corrupt places on that Transparency International index that you mentioned, the most corrupt are mostly conflict-ridden and very recently post-conflict.
Sudan, Afghanistan.
Somalia, these places. And actually, sort of Syria, Yemen, places like that are all feature in the top 10. And I think it's indicative of the fact that where there's a poor rule of law, it's very difficult to stamp out corruption. So it's symbiotic, obviously, but that it's hard to establish the rule of law while corruption is absolutely endemic. But I think having sort of functional state institutions and vaguely functioning rule of law, I think, are the first steps.
Indeed so. And that is all we have time for on today's Midori House. Thank you very much to Samira Shackle and Tim Marshall. Today's show was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Beatrice Carmi. Our studio manager was Kieran Matthew Banerjee. Music next, The Entrepreneurs at 1900 with Daniel Giacopelli. More on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. I'm back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London. But for now, I'm Andrew Mullett. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.